Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwunga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. My name's Jim Hutchings, flying solo today. Mona's on assignment, and our special guests this week are Aziz Aboudir, and you're going to have to excuse my pronunciation here, Ahmed Aniz and Valerie Zink. We have two topics this week which have in common Middle East peace and security. We'll be talking about is the Israeli Apartheid Week with Valerie Zink, an activist and community organizer in movements for migrant and refugee rights, indigenous sovereignty, and Palestine solidarity. She's been active for a number of years in the global campaign on boycotts, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Ahmed's going to add his expertise there as well. And then we'll be talking about the unrest in Libya over the past months with Aziz Aboudir, who was born in Libya and lived there for 4 years before emigrating to Canada with his family. He's in his third year of business administration at U of R with ambitions to enroll in law school. He keeps close ties back home with frequent visits and is distraught about the current situation. And Ahmed, you didn't give me any bio information, so you're going to have to tell me what you're all about.
Yeah, sure. I'm a graduate student at the University of Regina, and I work as a journalist for many years covering the conflict in Palestine and Israel. And I have some documentaries on the city, on the political situation there.
I see. And Valerie, how did you get involved with all this?
I still don't have really a simple answer to that. I guess I would just say, being on campus during the outbreak of the Intifada, as someone who was politically minded and aware of international events, it just made sense, something to learn more about and get involved with, just the same as I expect I would have been involved with the anti-apartheid movement against South Africa had I been, in undergrad during the 80s or 90s. And, it's one of many struggles going on around the world, and I don't think it's necessarily exceptional, and something that I'm involved with among many other issues.
So just basically something you became aware of during your studies at university.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's start off with some basic history of the situation. I think the average person on the street, when you start talking about Israel and the Palestinian situation, they really don't have clue one about how things have come to this, what were the beginnings. Let's start off with before 47, when Israel, the state of Israel, basically got started. Let's go beyond that, and I guess we can blame the British for an awful lot of what's happened in the Middle East. Ahmed, I'll throw the ball to you.
Yeah, the basic idea for the conflict started when one group claimed that Palestine is land without people, for a people without land. And that was the Zionist group and the Zionist activists who started to establish their own ideology of going to Palestine and took over the place because, as they mentioned, it's land without people, and they claim that they are people without land. So building on that base, they start to work towards convincing some superpower at that time, like the British, who took over after 1917, the First World War.
Right.
And that the British at that time issue a Balfour Declaration stating that they will secure this group state in Palestine,
right,
where the British, unfortunately, at that time, as a mandate, as a power in that region, They give something doesn't belong to them, to a people doesn't belong there. So right. It was a historic mistake. And unfortunately, the victim of all these kind of colonialism policies and is displacing the Palestinian, the indigenous people who lived there for centuries, and replace them with another European whatever people, and they call it the settlers and colonialism and colonies and settlements and stuff like that, where they became under the British mandate more and more like the population of them is became bigger and bigger. And then in 1944-45, when the Second World War ended, one religious group want to start their own countries and states. So in 1947, there was some kind of a serious international talk about divided the country into two states, what they call it the partition plan. In 1948, Israel was declared as a state for one religious group, displacing, and ended with a disaster and a catastrophe for the Palestinian who lived in and ended up in refugee camps all over the whole area over there in Gaza and West Bank and Jordan mm-hmm. and Syria and Lebanon and Egypt. And unfortunately, since 1948, the problem is continue. There was no serious effort to solve it. There was some kind of a treatment, but not really a serious any solution based on the human rights, based on this country for all people who live there, and they have to share it without any kind of religious whatever use of mm-hmm. this is for everybody. And people should get rights, and nobody should be victim of any other religion ideas or ideologies or attempt to disclose or exclude any other people. So unfortunately, we still in 2011, and as I said, millions of refugees still there, and they are looking for a solution for this problem.
Right, and the irony of all this, of course, is that over the centuries, all the different religious groups in that area lived peacefully without any problem until the British got involved, pretty much.
Yeah, unfortunately, we can say that for centuries and centuries and centuries, we have no really problems between religions mm-hmm. or because of religion over that area, except that the Crusades and, that 11th century. And since then, we don't really have any kind of serious problems.
Right.
Until the British took over after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire right. and the First World War. And this is the consequences of that kind of war and that kind of some kind of a new colonialism to that region.
Right. Okay, I guess we fast forward to today and what the situation is. We're in kind of the aftermath of the wars that the Palestinians or Arabs have had with the Israelis, and Israel is a very formidable military power. There's no question about that, and they're using their power to basically marginalize the Palestinians. To ghettoize them, I would say. The situation is worse in Gaza than anywhere, I think, because of the vast number of people that are in that area. Valerie, can you sort of elaborate on what's happening in Gaza right now?
Well, I guess the first thing to mention is the sanctions regime that's been imposed on Gaza, which Canada has actually been foremost among enforcing in the world. The Canadian government was actually the first government to respond following the democratic election of the Hamas government in 2006, even before Israel, to impose economic sanctions on the Gaza Strip, which at this point the World Bank has said is one of the most comprehensive sanctions regimes in modern history. So what we see are widespread shortages of food, of medicine, of building supplies. Gazans have been largely unable to rebuild following the recent invasion by Israeli forces into the Gaza Strip. They've been unable to even rebuild their homes and hospitals and basic infrastructure because we see materials like concrete and rebar and what have you are on a list of prohibited items together with, you know, things like jam and coffee or, you know, cardamom, basil, a completely arbitrary and obviously punitive list of prohibited items that Gazans are without under this sanctions regime, which has resulted in unemployment rates that are among the highest of the world and just widespread poverty that's by no means natural, but obviously an imposed poverty that is a means of punishing the Palestinian people for their choice of elected government in the hopes that they will ultimately turn against it.
Also, the Israeli government can't. They declare that they withdraw from Gaza and they wanna establish whatever a Palestinian entity or something like that. But it's kind of some way they are trying to siege the people of Gaza and keep the key. Like 70% of the people of Gaza are from refugee and are from the 1948 areas, and keep them in a small, tiny piece of land with all kind of problems and with a horrible shortage of everything, and call them this is an area. It's completely Israel got no hand on it, and then blocking everything from the air to the sea to the land. It's not going to solve the problem, and you can't really jail millions of people and call they are independence, but you are really having the key for that jail. You know, and this is the illusion about the story of Gaza, that they're trying to say that we have nothing to do with Gaza, but in fact that they completely control everything of Gaza.
Right.
The water, the air, the fish, the sea, the bird.
Yeah, well, as I started off with earlier, there's no question Israel has a superior military force there, and the idea of having any kind of a military solution is, it's just unthinkable. It's not the direction to go in, and you can just look at the recent attempts to breach the blockade by sea, and the Israelis seem to have no compunction whatsoever about coming out there into, what's basically, I think... Well, there's where some of the arguments is, was it international waters or not? But it almost doesn't matter. They're out there in force and blocking supplies, which, as far as we know, were humanitarian supplies. They will argue that, I suppose, but who knows?
No, we haven't seen any evidence to indicate anything to the contrary.
No, and the people sponsoring these shipments, they know that they have to go to great pains to avoid being accused of delivering military supplies, because that's definitely not what they're supposed to be doing. So all that aside, that's not working. There are other strategies now in place to try to have an impact on the situation there. It's sort of sanctions from the other direction. Valerie, would you like to take that?
Well, I think we're fortunate in the last few years in that the way for us to engage as international solidarity activists has become a lot more clear, particularly following the 2005 call from more than 170 Palestinian political and civil society organizations for a global movement of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And this has really, been the central focus of the international solidarity movement for the past 6 years, and I think rightfully so. And it's a way that we can each engage at a community level, recognizing, the myriad of different ways that we are each implicated in this conflict, whether that's economically as a result of the Canada-Free-Israel trade agreement, which has seen a threefold increase in trade between Canada and Israel in the last 15 years, and, produce in our local grocery stores, clothing in our department stores, what have you, and also politically on the world stage. But, as as students, as workers, as community organizers, we all have ways that we can directly engage in this boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. And I think we've seen a shift from, you know, the previous model of international solidarity in earlier years, like from 2000 to 2005, when we saw activists go to the West Bank and Gaza Strip and accompany farmers during the olive harvest, or, you know, serve as human rights witnesses during incursions. But, you know, what was ultimately a fairly problematic, I think, model for international solidarity, when you had people who were largely, you know, dissociated from that struggle, parachute in for a couple of weeks, do what they could, and then return home. Mm-hmm. Whereas now we're seeing a shift to people being active in their own communities, in their universities, in their faith groups, in their, you know, unions or what have you, with the understanding that, you know, we can no longer rely on our governments, we can no longer rely on international law or the United Nations to really effect any change in this conflict. We haven't seen that for the last 60 years. There's no reason to believe that that's forthcoming, and it's up to us at an individual level to take action. And also on the understanding that Israel is not, at this point, going to respond to moral arguments, which, you know, they're well aware of for decades and decades now, mm-hmm. and what we have to do is collectively, you know, raise the stakes such that the costs for continuing these policies of apartheid are simply not tenable for them anymore.
How does it work? When you say it's being brought to our own communities, how does an ordinary person in Regina, if he or she wants to demonstrate solidarity, how do you go about it?
There's a lot of different options, and what we've seen across Canada and internationally, you know, we have a consumer boycott, for example. So what that would mean is identifying both Israeli corporations but also international corporations that profit directly from occupation and apartheid, and where those goods and services are being sold in our communities, and boycotting those either products or businesses. In terms of divestment, we've seen labor groups researching their pension investments and divesting from, again, companies that are profiting from occupation and apartheid, and the same would go from student groups, so really, or faith-based groups or what have you. But it's really a question of looking in your community where you can find those ties to Israeli apartheid and severing that form of support.
What do you ultimately hope to achieve there? You know, it's one thing to sort of get their attention. That's basically what you're doing, is you're getting their attention. But what would you like the Israeli government to do? I mean, they're obviously not going to go away.
Oh, right. It's modeled, of course, after the boycott, sanctions, and divestment movement in apartheid South Africa. And the obvious goal is to isolate that regime internationally. And with that comes, as I said, very real consequences, whether that's politically or economically or what have you. So again, it's not just a matter of raising awareness or of presenting some sort of moral argument, but it's actually hurting the bottom line of that regime such that, you know, they're no longer able to continue those policies because it's not financially viable, it's not politically viable anymore. And there comes a time when you build sufficient, mm-hmm. you know, international support that will be the inevitable result.
Right. Well, it makes a whole lot more sense, I think, myself, than a military approach, you know. When you think of what's been accomplished so far by people picking up guns and weapons and stuff, and all you end up with is a lot of dead people. And
well, I mean, I think it's important to separate the role of international activists and a Palestinian liberation movement themselves, and I support their right to express that resistance in whatever form they deem fit and appropriate, whether that's, you know, in the occupied territories within Israel itself. There's more than a million Palestinian citizens who are also living under an apartheid regime in Israel, or the, you know, 5 million Palestinian refugees who live around the world. And so, like, I separate myself, obviously, appropriately, I think, from that struggle, that, you know, it's up to them to determine the ways that they choose to pursue that. But we have a mandate to the international community to respond through a boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which is broadly supported throughout, you know, the Palestinian population. And I think, you know, that is what's most clearly effective for someone sitting in Regina or Toronto or London or what have you, and that will be a very different form of engaging in the struggle than what's appropriate for someone in the Jenin refugee camp or a Palestinian refugee, and, mm-hmm. you know.
Okay, Ahmed, I'm going to give you a minute to wrap up here. We're just about done with looking at this section.
Yes, what's going on right now, you can't really imagine that's going to continue forever, because it must end it in a just solution for the people of Palestine and for the whole people over there. What's going on is the Israelis, because of their own huge support of, from the international superpower and national whatever, you know, backing them, they are not willing even not just to share that land. They are not willing to give citizen rights. And they want to keep all rights for themselves and their own people. And and that's, nobody can tolerate that in this in this time. I mean, you can't really send some settlers to a Palestinian populated area and give them all kind of freedom of movement and all kind of prosperity, and you lock the Palestinian in a small bandstand, cut it from each other legs. And lock the people of Gaza over there and call it a solution, a Oslo process, call it whatever you want. And look, we're having a peace process. Peace process for the last 20 years. It's nothing. It's ended, and it's actually increased the idea of apartheid regime. And that should end it. And I hope that the international community and all the supporters and all the people who are really aware of the situation to put an end for such a apartheid regime based on religion, you know. It's really an Middle Age ideas and ideologies. You know, you can't really tolerate, especially in Canada, where you have Canada for all Canadians, no matter what they belong to, what their own religion is.
I'm going to cut you off right at that point. And Val has one more thing to...
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that people know about Israeli Apartheid Week, which we're, is currently underway in Regina right now. It's the first year that we're participating in this international series of events, which began in 2005. This is the seventh annual year of Israeli Apartheid Week. And we had our first event on March 1st. The next one is coming up this coming Tuesday. We have Ali Abu Nima, a Palestinian-American journalist based in Chicago. He's the author of One Country and one of the co-founders of Electronic Intifada, which some of our listeners are hopefully familiar with. And he's going to be speaking at the University Theater at University of Regina on March 8th at 7 p.m. It's a free event, so we'd love people to come out. And they can check out our website, reginasolidaritygroup.com, for a full listing of events. There's a few more coming up next week as well. So we hope to see people out there.
Okay, and while we're doing announcements here, I just want to mention that Professor Angela Davis, a political American political activist, educator, and author, is going to be at speaking at the university. I've lost the... Oh, here we go.
March 7th.
It's March 7th? Thank you. I've got it right here someplace, but anyway, so that's happening. And what else do we have here? We have a fundraiser for Regina Women's Shelters at the OWL, 5:30 to 7:30 at the OWL on Thursday, March 10th. So be sure and take that in. And we're looking at International Women's Day, Saturday, March 12th, from 1 to 4 p.m. at the United Way Community Room at 1440 Scarth Street, Regina. The theme is The Many Hats of a Woman. And guest speakers are going to be the Honorable Dr. Linda Haverstock and Janice Taylor. And one more thing here. I'm just going to mention that Amnesty is having a fundraiser on Sunday, March 13th at the U of R Campus Club. $20. Pardon me, that's the Amnesty International U of R Campus Club. That's what it is. $20 fundraiser at the Hub Sports Bar. And I'll give you more details here later on. We have to head out for a break here, and we'll be right back. And I think I've played that on the show before. That particular bit of music was from some Israeli and Palestinian peace activists. They're people that want peace to happen in Israel, and they are friends, and they're trying to do their bit to make it happen. But anyway, on to a different topic here now. And we're going to talk about a country that has been in the news in the last few weeks quite a bit because of the unrest that's happening in the Middle East. We started off with Egypt and President Mubarak having to step down, and then a similar thing happened in Tunisia, and now we have a lot of unrest in Libya, and we have a situation where the leader there doesn't want to step down. So we're just going to start talking here now about that. And we have Aziz Aboudir. That's, I know I'm brutalizing the pronunciation of your name there. Oh, so okay, not too bad. All right. and Ahmed is here with us as well. He's stayed. Valerie has had other things that she had to attend to, so she's left. So we just have the two of you here. I guess the first question that I have here for you is, I guess I should turn your mic on. That would really help. There. Okay. I've talked about Egypt and Tunisia. Do you think that what happened there is part of the reason why we were seeing the unrest happen in Libya, or was this all happening at the same time?
It's part of the reason. It's definitely not the only reason. The Libyan people have tried to stand up to Gaddafi in the past. They've tried to oppose the regime, only to be silenced immediately through the use of violence, mm-hmm. Arrests. So there have been incidents of people rising up in the past. However, he silenced them quickly. And It gained momentum through what Tunisia and Egypt experienced after Tunisia's president Zain Ben Ali was overthrown. The Egyptians had some hope from that, and they aspired to achieve the same. So after that happened with Egypt, the Libyan people got some hope from that as well. They thought, well, it is achievable to overthrow a dictator, no mm-hmm. matter how long it has been. If you want, I have just a short, like, general idea to give listeners about what's
sure.
going on. I can just read it. It'll take about 10 minutes or less.
Okay. Go ahead.
Is that fine?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Then we'll know something.
Absolutely. I mean, some people just don't know the general idea, so this way everybody will be on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so January 2011, Tunisian residents revolt against their longtime president slash dictator of 24 years, Zain Bel Abidine Bel Ali. This protest was sparked by a young man setting himself on fire because of his frustration of high unemployment, food inflation, corruption, a lack of freedom of speech, and other political freedoms. 28 days later, on January 4th, Zain Bin Ali fled the country and sought asylum in Saudi Arabia. The Tunisian people relished in their victory and newfound freedom. The power of many had overcome the dictatorial rule of one, and residents prepared themselves for a democratic road ahead. Fewer than 100 people died during these protests. 2 weeks later, on January 25th, protests broke out in Egypt to oppose the 30-year rule of President Hosni Mubarak. Egyptians were sick of similar conditions that plagued Tunis and its working class: low wages, police brutality, non-existing jobs, and a lack of political and personal freedom. After 18 days of protest, Hosni Mubarak finally stepped down as president of Egypt. Roughly 400 people were killed throughout the course of these protests. Nearby, the Libyan people, nestled between the countries of Egypt and Tunis in North Africa, were hungry for freedom as well. Unfortunately, little did they know that the price they would need to pay for it would far exceed that of both Egypt and Tunis combined. Libya is a country in North Africa ruled by the Colonel Muammar Gaddafi for the past 42 years. There are no elections, there's no political process, no one is allowed to form any political parties lest they face severe consequences. To give you but one example of this man's intolerance to the slightest opposition, I'll cite two events. First, April of 1976. Students at Al-Fatah University in the largest city, capital city of Tripoli, formed a student union that was not backed by the Gaddafi government. And his response to this was to publicly hang the students right on campus in front of their colleagues and professors. Countless professors and university students were hanged for expressing their opinion against Gaddafi regime. And similarly, the massacre of Abu Slim prison, where 1,200 prisoners were murdered in under 3 hours, all political prisoners held with no court proceedings and no political process. No perpetrators were identified, nothing to document these killings as if it didn't happen. This is but the tip of the iceberg of Gaddafi's crimes. He's jailed, tortured, kidnapped, murdered thousands throughout his rule, simply for speaking up against his regime and trying to create a better Libya for all. Everyone, including myself, were actually skeptical whether the Libyan people would incite a similar revolution to that of Tunis and Egypt. And it's understandable, because everyone was aware of this man's ruthlessness and indifference to the suffering of his own people. Throughout his 42-year reign of terror, he has proven time and time again how cold-hearted, bloodthirsty, and ruthless he can be. That's why it came as a surprise when, on February 15th, residents of the eastern city of Benghazi, the second largest city in Libya, revolted against the Gaddafi regime, taking to the streets in angry protest. Completely unarmed, with only their voices, hands, and passionate want for freedom, they faced police forces loyal to Gaddafi and were immediately met with live bullets. Not tear gas, not hot water cannons, not rubber bullets, batons, or shields, but live bullets aimed at the head and chest to kill, all on the first day. Every Libyan's fear instantly became a reality, and the realization sunk in that in order to attain our freedom from this oppressive regime, we had to be ready to sacrifice a lot. The first day alone, 30 or so unarmed protesters were killed by police forces. The Libyan people organized February 17th through social media websites such as Facebook to be the International Day of Rage, where everyone would take to the streets and speak up against this corrupt regime. And so it began. As the days closed, an increasing number of men and youth took to the streets to voice their discontent for the regime. And as they poured out, the death toll began to rise. All unarmed civilians with only one goal and dream in mind: to overthrow a dictator of 4 decades and attain their freedom. Police, soldiers, and military were ordered to kill their own citizens, the same citizens that they were once there to protect. Those who refused were bound and burned alive or executed by a bullet to the head. These executions were documented through YouTube videos taken by cell phone cameras. Due to the restriction imposed by the government that bans external media from entering the country, things began to take a turn for the worst. Internet, telecommunications, and cell phones were shut down. Libya was put in a state of blackout for a couple days. Military personnel and soldiers were defecting and refusing to kill their own brothers and sisters. The eastern city of Benghazi, after a bloody battle between Gaddafi loyalists and opposition where hundreds died, was liberated from the control of Gaddafi. With no more supporting forces in that area, what do you think this tyrant elects to do? He sets up advertisements in other countries, such as Chad and Niger, for mercenaries. He hires them and flies them into the country to kill his own people. These mercenaries have been documented through videos and through personal reports of people living in Libya. "I will fight till the last bullet and die on Libyan soil," is what Gaddafi said. He's using anti-aircraft weapons on civilians, bombing his citizens and slaughtering them by the hundreds. Ambulances full of not paramedics, but mercenaries, were deployed against the people of Tripoli last Friday. Anything is an option for this man. The death toll has surpassed over 2,000, with thousands more injured and many more missing or jailed, unknown to be dead or alive. This has been the bloodiest revolution of any country in that region thus far, and it is yet to end. Meanwhile, no media outlets are allowed in the country to report on this barbaric massacre, and the only sources of news that the world is left to rely on are cell phone videos shot by brave young men, Twitter posts, Facebook news feeds, and teleconferences. Meanwhile, Libyan state television is broadcasting footage of Gaddafi support rallies and pro-Gaddafi demonstrations. Meanwhile, this criminal is interviewed by ABC News and tells the world that there are no protests. What are you talking about? Have you seen any protests? And he also says, "My people love me, they would die to protect me," when in fact it's the complete opposite. They would die to get rid of him. Although the eastern city of Benghazi has been liberated, the capital of Tripoli is still very much under his control, with security forces stationed on every street corner and a strict curfew in effect. There were a couple days of protests which claimed many young men's lives and even women. However, people are still under fear. Groups of individuals are not allowed to travel together. Even the funerals of the dead cannot be attended by more than 10 people, lest security forces intervene. Gaddafi is offering each citizen $500 as some sort of welfare money to quell the unrest. This actually happened a couple days ago. Meanwhile, the Libyan state television records citizens collecting their money and shopping for essential food and supplies so they can air to the world that life is still normal and carefree. Benghazi is under fear that it may be attacked by regime air forces any day now, and they're trying to plan an offensive with what little supplies and weapons they have. Any sort of attempt to take over by Benghazi opposition would require an enactment of a no-fly zone above Libya to prevent Gaddafi airstrikes and opposition forces, and they would also need an increase in ammunition and weapons. The purpose of this presentation is just to help educate everyone about what's really going on inside of Libya, because proper news reports are not allowed to take place in this country under siege. It is up to each and every one of us to spread the truth about this murderous regime. It's up to us to bring to light their crimes against humanity, their disregard for human rights, their outright murder of their own people. There once was a time where everyone was afraid to speak out, where even Libyan citizens in Canada, like me, were careful of what they said about the government. A time where if you were approached by a new Libyan and asked political questions, you would either stay neutral or pro-Gaddafi. For if you spoke up against the regime, you would be jailed upon arrival at the airport to visit your friends and family. This time wasn't too long ago. In fact, it was only 2 weeks ago. But now it's a time for change, a time to take a stand, a time where we speak out to the world and say enough is enough. Enough silence, enough oppression, enough bloodshed, enough murdering, enough Gaddafi. For those who do not speak up against injustice are just as guilty as the ones perpetrating it.
Wow. That's our show. That's incredible. When you look at what's going on around the world, everything, the only thing that comes close, I think, is Myanmar in terms of control. Even the folks in Myanmar are a little more, they're not quite as open about the repression, that's for sure. So you have friends and or family there?
Well, about all my family's in Libya, and many friends are in Libya. 99% of my family is in Libya, and currently my mom's side of the family is in El Zawiya, and if you tune into recent news, just today there, after Friday prayer, there have been more attacks on Zawian residents after Friday prayer, because they're trying to dispel the crowd. When people gather for Friday prayer at mosques, there's many people in one location, and there's more chance that they will start protesting on the streets. So immediately after Friday prayer is over, he deploys gunmen, mercenaries, police, and soldiers to scare and frighten people to go back to their homes, and people were killed today. Right. Now, all unarmed civilians, of course. Nobody in Libya has weapons. Since day one, it's impossible to get a gun in Libya. There was a ban on 4x4 vehicles, less people would travel down to Africa or other countries to get weapons, to smuggle weapons. There's a, Gaddafi has kept a very close watch on his country for the past 42 years. He anticipated this day coming. I mean, it's only, you can only stay in power for so long. Even the even the Benghazi military were never as loyal to Gaddafi as the Tripoli military. So he didn't give them the best equipment. He didn't train them. He knew that this day might come and that they might revolt. So right now, even though Benghazi has been taken over by opposition, it's the second biggest city, they don't have the firepower or the or the technology or the weapons or the means to even create an offensive and to move forward to Tripoli. They don't have any aircraft. Even if they try to incite an offensive, they will be bombed by Gaddafi or air forces. That's why, in my opinion, and many other, lots of other Libyans' opinions, enactment of a no-fly zone by either NATO or the U.S. is critical to the overthrow of this dictator. Although it would involve bombing Libya to take out anti-aircraft missiles and U.S. Air Force is flying on top of Libya to enforce the no-fly zone, I think without that, there's no hope for the opposition to overthrow the government.
I think here, in terms of the popular uprising on the Middle East in general, that this uprising will continue in a way that to reach the rest of the Arab regimes over there, like the Saudi Arabia and Yemen and Syria and all other dictatorship, because unfortunately in many of them being really backed and supported by the U.S. because of U.S. interests over there for the oil, for the resources, and etc. So as you might know about the history over there, after the First World War, the British took over most of that area, which is supposedly used to be under the Ottoman Empire, and unfortunately they set each family on a wheel of oil, and they divided that area to like Sheikhdom and Kingdom and all these kind of pieces, which is deeply does not belong to this century. And unfortunately, when any kind of popular uprising there, the superpower, they just care about their own interests. They don't support the people. And what's going on now is, as you saw in the Egyptian case, Egyptian dictator Mubarak, he was for 30 years, and he used to get some aid from the United States, money like $2 billion a year or something like that for 30 years.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the United States just realized that this is, how come the people against this dictatorship, 30 years he ruled over there, and every year he got $2 billion from the United States money. So, and I hope, I mean, they will not continue in supporting this corrupt dictatorship around that region, especially in other areas like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and the rest of these families, which is declared this is the state for the family, you know, because, I mean, Saudi family has just declared that this country belongs to Saudi family. And what's this? I mean, who can really understand this kind of country or a state belong to a family, you know? So it's something really need to be changed. And I hope that the international community stop supporting dictatorship for oil and stop really backing some of them because of whatever interest here and there. And they should be with the people, you know? And the people over there is really in need for freedom and democracy, and they need to be like any other free people around the world.
Do you think that there's any chance of success of the uprising in Libya if the international community does not get involved?
I think the international community and we should be a little bit aware of any kind of intervention in terms of military intervention.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because military intervention will be used from Gaddafi that, look, the Western power want to topple me down.
Yeah.
And I am against the foreign invasion. So he might recruit some people
for
that.
A military invasion would actually shift the focus from a fight from freedom and democracy and humanitarian rights to a fight against America and the West and colonial power. It would actually incite some people to switch sides. And then Gaddafi would say, like my colleague here said, look, I've been speaking out against America. This is what you guys got yourself into. Now we have to fight them back. Mm-hmm. And there were people that would side with Gaddafi after that to fight, because we don't want another Iraq to happen, another Afghanistan. We don't want another occupation. If they're in there, how long will they stay? What are they going to do? When will they leave? We don't know that. It's uncertain. Yeah. And we would rather avoid that uncertainty 100%. Like I said, any type of intervention, I mean, with foreign troops on the soil is not supported by any Libyan, including myself, or any Arab, or any many of the international communities. If it comes down to it, and you asked, is there any hope for overthrowing Gaddafi if there's no type of intervention? It's really tough to say, because in order to overthrow him without intervention, that would require the uprising of the Tripoli people, and it would be a bloodbath, it would be a massacre, because he does have security forces stationed on every corner of the city. And in order for them to succeed, everybody would need to unite. However, the living conditions in Tripoli aren't as bad as Benghazi. They are pretty bad, but they aren't as bad. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot more Gaddafi loyalists in Tripoli. And many people are still scared. You call some of your relatives back home, they won't say anything because their phones are tapped and they're scared. Everybody's still scared. He still has a stranglehold on the capital city of Tripoli. And until that's toppled, he will not be out of power. And the military, through military power of the Benghazi or other opposition, it's unfortunately not sufficient to take down Gaddafi unless they get weapons or some sort of aid from America or something else, unless America offers them weapons, or unless they enact a no-fly zone, or they bomb Gaddafi's compound.
But they have to stay out.
But they have to stay out.
Yeah.
That's the key point. And that I echo every Libyan's thoughts on that, every Libyan's beliefs on that. We do not want foreign troops on Libyan soil under any circumstances. Mm-hmm. It's a fight for the Libyan people, and they need to achieve their freedom.
Okay. Well, I think we've kind of really concentrated all the information there and told it like it was, and I've got some announcements that I have to over again here, because I was kind of rushed the first time. And all right, one thing I didn't mention is Alec Neave, the Secretary General of Amnesty International Canada, is going to be speaking at a special event organized by the Amnesty International Regina Community Group and the University of Regina Amnesty International Club. His presentation, Amnesty International After 50 Years, Looking Back and Looking Forward, is especially relevant this year as Amnesty International marks our 50th anniversary. So that's at 7 p.m. On March the 4th. That's today. I'm going. Yes. Yes. That's 7 p.m. today. It's a potluck dessert, and it'll be held at All Saints Anglican Church, 142 Massey Road, just south of Campbell Collegiate. And I just mentioned the U of R Campus Club Amnesty International Fun Night, Steak Night Fundraiser, $20. That's on March 13th from 4 to 9 at the Hub Sports Bar. Tickets, call Aurora at 551-5650 or Shane at 526-5831. And, we've got vegetarian options available there. And I think that is, let's see what, I'll tell you what. First of all, I'd like to thank you two for coming. Ahmed, it's always good to hear your opinions on things.
Oh, and, pleasure.
And I appreciate, Aziz, your being here. Your appearance here basically shows a fair amount of courage, because you don't know what's happening, what's going to happen back in Libya or anything like that.
No.
So
anybody speaking up against the regime right now, if he stays in power, more or less put on a blacklist. Our entry into Libya is questionable after this, to visit friends or relatives. So we're hoping with all our hearts that we know he won't step down, that he does get overthrown.
I guess we can only hope for the best and hope that the powers that be in the international community react with some restraint, but give the support that's required to bring justice to the people in Libya.
Absolutely.
And our time is up, so we're closing this week's Human Rights Radio, and we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. Our goal is to increase the awareness of and contribute to a discussion of human rights issues at home and around the world. To discover how you can contribute to the abolition of human rights violations, visit our website at amnestysaskatchewan.ca or check out our Facebook group at Amnesty International Saskatchewan and follow the links. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."